Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, a conversation designed to help leaders go further, faster. Now, if you're new to our leadership podcast, you know that normally Lane Jones is your host, but today I'm hosting because I have my friend Cheryl Batchelder in the studio with me, which means I get to ask the questions. Cheryl, thanks so much for joining us on this podcast.
I'm delighted to be here, Andy.
Well, we're delighted that you're here, and those on the other end of this microphone who know you are certainly delighted, and those who are about to be introduced to you are going to be even more delighted. Now, as some of you may know, Cheryl is the CEO of Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Cheryl joined Popeye's in November of 2007 after serving as a member of the board of directors for about a year. To this role, she brought, and this is amazing, more than 35 years of experience in brand building operations, running a public company at companies like Domino's Pizza, RJR Nabisco, the Gillette Company, and Procter & Gamble. So this is going to be an extraordinarily helpful conversation. In fact, this conversation isn't going to be an extraordinarily helpful conversation. This is going to be two conversations. So Cheryl will be back with us next month for part two of what we're going to begin today. Cheryl's an author. She's written a fantastic book called Dare to Serve, How to Drive Superior Results by Serving Others. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. So this really is an extraordinary opportunity for us, and we're going to get to Cheryl in just a minute, I promise. But over the past 3 years, I've had an opportunity to get to know Cheryl as a friend, and she's one of those amazing people that the closer you get, the more you like her and the more you appreciate her. And she's going to tell her stories about the, you know, these past 8 years at Popeye's. But I want to give you a few details before we jump into the details of her story. You should know that this really is a turnaround story. Popeye's is actually an international restaurant chain. They've got like 2,500 plus different stores in 28 different countries. So 2,500 stores in 28 different countries. And when Cheryl came to Popeye, she walked into a very tough business environment that she'll tell you about. She figured out what needed to be done, then she got it done. And the results have been phenomenal, both for employees and for stockholders, just to pick one measure. When Cheryl came to Popeye's, the stock was about $13 a share. And as of today, Cheryl, we just checked it, $57 a share. So you're not just a leader. You're an extraordinary leader with the numbers to back it up. So let's begin with some background. Tell us how you became CEO and then a little bit more about the situation that you walked into.
Well, in the spring of 2007, I was sitting on the board of Popeye's when the CEO resigned unexpectedly. I knew the situation well, had been there about a year in a board role. Restaurant sales had been steadily declining. The restaurant profits were going down as well for our franchise owners. The stock price was declining, and basically no one was happy. The franchise owners were outright mad, the employees were discouraged at the lack of results, and the shareholders were certainly frustrated. So the board asked me to sit on the subcommittee to select the next CEO. After a couple of very talented people turned down our offers, the committee asked me, actually they asked me if I'd step outside the room for a minute while they talked. And when I came back in, they asked me would I consider taking the job. It really caught me by surprise. I wasn't looking for a job, but it was exactly the kind of business challenge that I enjoy. Popeye's was an incredible brand that had gone off course, and that is exactly the kind of situation that I like to tackle to make a brand, a business, an enterprise become contemporary, relevant, and growing again. So I went home. My husband and I talked it over on the weekend, and I came back the next Monday and took the job.
Wow. So let me just ask you this. So you've been on the board for a year, you said? So you saw the situation. Apparently, you knew or at least knew of the two people they had asked to take this position. While you were sitting there, did it ever cross your mind, I'd like to do this? I wish, you know, if I were in charge, here's what I would do. I mean, as a leader, don't we all have those thoughts at certain points? Did that cross your mind?
You know, I hadn't really thought about getting an offer for the position. But what I had thought about is I had always hoped that I would have another opportunity to come into a company and create the culture for superior performance results. I knew I could do the brand turnaround part. I had a lot of experience and skills in that area. But I really wanted to see if servant leadership could drive performance results. And that was my underlying personal reason.
And servant leadership is something we've all heard of and heard people talk about. So when you say servant leadership, especially within the context of a publicly traded company, what did that mean for you?
I'll tell you what it's come to mean to me. It's come to mean to me that you have a courageous business plan that takes people to what I call a daring destination, but you humbly come alongside those people and help them get there. It's an organization that creates an environment where people perform their best. And I've discovered that it is in that intersection between the courage and the humility of the leader that you create the conditions for people to perform well.
And I would think that a lot of people listening to our podcast think, okay, that sounds a little bit kind of pie in the sky. Does that really, really work within a corporate environment? And I think one of the great things about you being here and one of the great things about your book is it's not just theory. You believed in this, then you had the opportunity to implement it, and the results, you know, the results speak for themselves.
Well, and the only reason I wrote a book is I wanted to document that you can do this. There is a how-to plan. There's a lot of academics and consultants that have written books about servant leadership, and there's very few practitioners. Mm. So my whole point was to write down what we did in hopes that it might help others create a similar environment. Because in people's hearts of hearts, they know that the leader that has created their best opportunities has taken risks on them and had their back. And so everyone knows it's logical, yep. But very few people are practicing it.
Wow. All right. So they ask you to take the job. You take a weekend to think about it. You come back, you say, I'm in. So tell us a little bit about, because you talked about this in your book, tell us a little bit about the first time you met with the Popeyes franchisees, who was there, how many. And that day you stood up and you cast a vision. It was a brand new, fresh vision. So just tell us a little bit about that dynamic.
My first day on the job was at the International Franchise Owner Meeting in Orlando, Florida. If you'd imagine a hotel with about 800 or 900 people in it, I was standing on a huge stage with my PowerPoint presentation, and I was going to give the owners confidence that we would get Popeyes back on track. I said this bold thing. I said, one day Popeyes will be the hottest concept among quick service restaurants.
Wow.
We will have sales per restaurant of $1.2 million. We will have restaurant profit of 22%. We'll have speed of service that is below 180 seconds. Per car at our drive-thrus, and we'll build more than 100 restaurants in the U.S., plus a lot more around the globe.
And at that point, sales were more along the lines of what per restaurant?
So at that time, our sales were under $1 million. So I said sales will be up 20%, restaurant profit will be up 40%. Drive-thru times, I won't even mention. They were so slow. And we were building a lot of restaurants, but they weren't profitable. They weren't staying open. So we needed to build quality restaurants with great sales and profitability so our restaurant owners would get good returns.
So when you stood up, and again, this was the first time many of these people had ever laid eyes on you, and it's the first time you'd been with the entire organization or what
right.
represents the entire organization. And yet, when I read this statement, because it's in your book, the thing that hit me was it was so certain. You know, five times you said, we will, we will, we will, not we will strive to. And the other thing I loved about this vision cast, it wasn't we have a problem and we're going to solve it. It wasn't we're going to get up, you know, to the waterline. We're not going to get to break even. This would have been a bold statement in terms of the growth you projected if the company had been healthy. So to come into a very unhealthy situation and to cast a purely positive vision like that, I mean, what was your thinking? Was it? I'm sure it wasn't spontaneous. You had PowerPoint, so you were ready to flash this stuff up there. But can you talk a little bit about what was behind that? That was extraordinarily bold.
Well, I certainly wasn't confident of what the future would hold. But what I was certain of was what we had to do to be a viable, growing restaurant chain. Those goals that I stated were steep hills for Popeyes, but they were goals that other growing, prosperous restaurant chains were achieving. They were plausible. So we had to chase those goals, or we would gradually become obsolete. I concluded it was either go big or go home.
Wow. And what was the response?
Well, skepticism. One franchisee said to me, Cheryl, you need to understand our situation. There had been four CEOs in 7 years. And
oh,
he
wow.
said, Cheryl, we are the foster children, and you are the new foster parent. It will take some time for us to trust you.
Yeah.
And I think he was willing to be candid with me that great vision, but we'll see.
Yeah. So if nothing else, when you finished, they knew you were serious. They didn't know whether or not you could pull it off, but they knew you'd thought it through and that you were serious about this.
And I think, Andy, they also knew that I understood the serious issues at the business at the time. I took them seriously. And these bold goals said, look, we are where we are, but we are going to go somewhere better. A significant turnaround is required. This isn't going to be status quo. I at least conveyed to them that I understood the depth of the problem. So I think what the vision did is it temporarily calmed the organization. At least we were going to go somewhere very specific. It was something to shoot for. And I think most of all, Andy, it was something to hope for.
And the fact that you had benchmarked your goals against something that was realistic in terms of the industry. So it wasn't just pie in the sky. You know, I would read this and think, is that even realistic? So these were realistic goals, but they were stretch goals. And again, they would have been a bit of a stretch for a healthy organization. So you cast this extraordinary vision. You walk off the stage. People are skeptical because now it's going to say, well, let's see, you know, wait and see, wait and see. So what happened immediately following that?
After the conference, I went back to Atlanta and gathered the senior team together. And of course, I'm meeting some of them for the first time too. We then needed to decide how we were going to attack these major issues that were hampering the performance of the company and how we would overcome our challenges. That room had about 30 people in it, and they knew exactly what was wrong at Popeyes. They quickly made a list. They put it up on the post-it boards. They said we didn't have any compelling new products. We didn't have a great ad campaign. We had slow, poor restaurant operations. We had below-average profitability due to things like our supply chain wasn't what it needed to be. And we had been building these restaurants on second-class real estate, and therefore they just simply weren't going to deliver the returns. So the list of what was wrong came very quickly from the people.
And you took this job knowing all of that? Was any of this new news, or was this, again, like you said early on, this was, hey, don't throw me in the briar patch. This is exactly the kind of opportunity I'm looking for. So obviously none of this discouraged you, but you knew this going in?
Well, I do love complex problem solving, and I certainly saw that in this situation. But always, if you're a bold leader, you're going to discover more things to solve than you expected.
Yep.
And I think leaders have to go in expecting that every rock you pick up is going to have a little bit more doo-doo under it than you expected. And that was certainly the case.
And then in the book, you say that, we can almost predict this, any of us who've been through anything similar to this. In the middle of this meeting, someone raises their hand and they ask the question that we have either asked personally or we've heard someone ask after a situation like this. Tell us about that.
Well, at one point in this meeting, a leader raised her hand and said, Cheryl, every year we make this same list at the offsite meeting.
Yep, we've all been there.
It took my breath away, though. It just took my breath away to hear it out loud.
Wow.
I took a long pause and I looked back at Sandra and said, would you like to be on the team that actually does solve these problems? And she said, you bet your life.
Wow.
So the people always know what's wrong in an organization, but it's the leader that has to call out the vital few things that are going to change the future performance. And the people wait for the leader to call it out.
Now, this is such a big idea. So if everybody knows what's wrong, or if enough people know what's wrong, and again, it's the frontline people, it's the people that are actually, that their job description forces them to confront the issues in the organization. This is a really big issue. So because if everybody knows what's wrong, or if enough people know what's wrong, or the frontline people know what's wrong, or the people that are actually dealing with customers and clients, if they know, why don't organizational leaders work on fixing the important things? And what did you do specifically to make sure you were listening to the front lines people and, again, didn't just drift back into the bureaucracy of doing whatever, you know, CEOs of publicly traded companies do?
So, Andy, you're right. This is such an important observation. The only thing that I did to make sure this all came to the surface was to call the meeting and say, everybody come in a room and tell me what's wrong in this organization. But here's the thing leaders often forget. Organizations do not take risks. Leaders take risks.
Could you repeat that, please? That's such a big, big, big idea.
So organizations don't take risks. Leaders take risks.
Yep.
The leaders are the ones that have to decide and declare what the daring destination is for the people. And if the leader doesn't do that, the people work on 100 other things that are far less risky, far less likely to fail. They essentially hunker down and hide under their desks. So at Popeyes, on this particular day that we had this meeting, I asked for the project list, and our teams were working on 128 active projects.
Before you got there?
Before we started this meeting.
So things are going really, really poorly, and they are working on 128 different projects.
They are exceptionally busy. exceptionally busy. But interestingly, none of the things on that list were aimed at tackling and fixing our biggest issues that were on the post-it boards we'd just written. And all of those things were holding back the performance of the company. So I think it's important to remind leaders that the people are going to stand around and look very busy. They want to feel needed. They want to say, I'm contributing. And they know the results are dismal. So to get them to stand up and to the task of what needs to be fixed is the leader's ultimate challenge. Now, Steve Jobs at Apple once said it this way. He said, people think that focus means saying yes to the things you've got to focus on. But that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the 100 other good ideas that there are. I really believe that to be true, that the people will create work until the leader focuses them on the vital few things.
Cheryl, this is such a big idea. Again, the leader's most important role, see if I get this right, is to narrow the focus of the organization to the vital few things. I think that is the big challenge of leadership, because I've sat in meetings like the one you discussed, or even here through a productive leadership team meeting where we're discussing important things. We narrow it down to some things that we need to do, need to change. And I'm already thinking in the back of my mind, yeah, but as soon as this meeting's over, I have another appointment. And I'm going to go to that appointment. And next thing I know, my calendar will rule my time as it's going to rule the time of every single person sitting around this table. And nothing is going to change. And therein is probably the primary challenge of leadership, to make sure those words and ideas are actually implemented. But that is not an easy thing to do.
So just to further that thought, Andy, we had a process we called creating a roadmap for results, and we put 7 initiatives on that roadmap that we thought would drive performance. And the people got scared that their projects weren't on the roadmap.
The ones they were already working on.
Correct.
That weren't making any difference.
And they panicked, essentially.
Wow.
Because we had defined the most important work, and their 128 projects wasn't on the list. So the next thing we had to do is we had to challenge them to figure out how they could support the 7 projects that would change the performance of the organization. And we said, go back to your desk and don't do the same thing. Figure out how to get on a team of people that can help fix these 7 things. And it was a very scary time. I think sometimes leaders forget how frightening it is for the organization to go through bold change.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing that happened is we gave them permission to let go of the non-impact work in favor of the 7 things that would change performance.
This is such a big idea. So it wasn't enough to say, here's some new things we're going to do. Almost at the individual job description level, you had to go back, or you went back and said, stop doing what we hired you to do in some cases. Stop working on the projects that your previous manager or the previous CEO gave you permission and gave you budget dollars to work
right.
on. So this is a big deal. So Cheryl, did each individual department or division manager decide what to stop working on? Was this sort of a permission-giving thing, and then you sent them away to say, hey, whatever you need to stop doing in order to start doing the following 7 things, I'm giving you permission to do that, or was there more instruction than that?
So the first thing we said is we're going to assemble teams of people to work on these 7 strategies. If you have the appropriate skills, get on a team. Okay, that was rule number one.
So they self-selected for these teams to some extent?
They volunteered.
Wow.
They volunteered, and then we selected. We actually interviewed people to work on teams on each of these 7 things. That was entirely new at the organization,
yeah.
to work with people of different functions like finance and marketing and operations all coming together to solve a problem. So that was the first thing we said was we're going to create teams. The second thing we said is we're going to attach resources to those teams. So if you want dollars attached to your work, it's going to go to these teams because these are the problems we want to solve and fix.
So then everybody got motivated to be on a team.
Correct.
And they quit doing all those 128 things that were about to be somewhat unfunded.
And we unfunded them.
Yeah.
So we did both. And then we said, honestly, there are day job activities, like we're still going to process contracts and we're still going to pay the bills. So there are day jobs. Talk to your supervisor. You know, you may have a day job function that we desperately need you to continue to doing highly effectively, and we value that. But it ended the busy work conversation. Yep. Now, I'll tell you this, though, Andy. Busy work has creep. It comes right back.
Really?
It comes right back.
That's not just here?
No, it's not just here. It's everywhere. And so we go through this process now annually. And every year, we add up all the projects that have mushroomed, and we cut back to 7 or 8 things.
Okay, let me make this a little bit more personal. In Dare to Serve, you say that you're not certain why leaders oftentimes resist fixing the hard stuff that stands between mediocre and superior performance. You mentioned several potential culprits, you know, fear of failure, absence of ideas, worry about resources, a lack of courage. So here's my question. Did you resist, or is it just your nature to kind of step into that space? Was there something in you that's like, this is too big, this is too messy, I think I'll just go do what CEOs do? So did you have to work through anything personally, or is it just your nature to, you know, forget the normal stuff, I'm going to wade in quickly?
I think, to be honest, it's my nature to do bold things, Andy. I love to solve big, complicated problems. I've grown up in the field of marketing and product development where you create ideas and innovation and you create solutions that build strong brands. And so that bold idea part of my wiring and my training certainly kicked in here. When you look at my personality traits, there's a standout assessment. It's by Marcus Buckingham that kind of looks at what your towering strengths are. I recently took a standout assessment, which comes from Marcus Buckingham's organization, and the assessment called me something, a pioneer creator.
A pioneer creator. That's a good one.
I love the two words. You know, I guess it sounded right to me. But it described my approach in a sense. It said, you are a perpetual fountain of new, bold ideas. And when I read that description to my team at Popeyes, they started laughing uncontrollably. So I think that means it's true.
Okay, but Cheryl, I know people. In fact, I work with some people who are, let me say it the way you said it, perpetual fountains of new, bold ideas. And every day they have a new idea. They have a new initiative. And they're, you know, you just can't do everything.
That's
so
right.
How do you harness that if you're wired that way?
That is the most important weakness of my profile, is to not focus and execute my ideas. So I have to be extremely self-aware because, frankly, at Popeyes, we have had bold ideas that have turned around this company. But the real courage was to follow through and to be disciplined to execute those ideas in the marketplace. One of my early bosses said, a mediocre idea executed brilliantly wins every time. And that quote annoyed the daylights out of me. I only wanted to do big, bold ideas. But it turns out he was way more right than wrong. The hardest part of business is actually doing your big ideas. That is much harder than thinking them up. And so what I've had to learn to do is complement myself with leaders that are very strong on execution and process, things that I don't naturally go to, and limit my bold ideas to the few that will have the most impact on the business.
So Cheryl, as we wrap up the first part of a two-part conversation, would you just address our podcast audience directly? And just, would you just speak to the leaders who are listening, and they would admit, you know what, I'm very busy, the people in our organization are very busy, but I'm not sure we're busy doing the right things, the most strategic things. What would you say to them just generally?
Well, first, I would say that's exactly the right question to ask annually in your organization. What we try to do at Popeyes now is once a year we go off-site and we just stop all the moving plates, spinning plates, and say, are we working on the right things that will have a material impact on the business? And then we go back, just like we did this first time, and we say to the people, what are you busy with and what should you be working on? So there's nothing more important than asking the organization what they're working on, focusing them on the vital few, and giving them permission to stop working on the things that are not driving results. And remember that defunding them is the best way to get them to stop.
So essentially, defunding takes all the fun out of those projects anyway.
Correct.
Well, Cheryl, thanks so much for your time today. And to all of our listeners, we're going to be right back here next month with Cheryl, so you will not want to miss part two of this incredible conversation. If you want to hear more about her incredible story and what's happening at Popeyes, check out her book, Dare to Serve. In addition to that, she has a fantastic blog and other resources that you can find at CherylBatchelder.com. That's Cheryl Batchelder, BACHELDER.com.